intimidated, but I'm sure like Mike and Ray know too that parents are often intimidated by the school system. So those of us that have taught for a long time know that people often are afraid to like deal with a bureaucracy like a school system. It's the same thing with the voting system. And, you know, adults, you know, don't want to be embarrassed or look foolish. So I've, you know, tried to make sure that it's always respectful when I reach out to voters and try to engage them. And I have had partners in the community who have been helped me, you know, with that, and we've been pretty successful. I'm also a CUSH representative on the Kenosha Emergency Services Network, and a small team of us has recently been working on a new educational program for the whole community, because many people who have been impacted by the pandemic are now struggling and reaching out for help, people who never did that before. And, you know, it's hard to know where to begin. So we have developed a Kenosha Community Virtual Resource Series. And in January, we did one on food and rental assistance. February, we talked about the many programs at the Job Center. And just about a week and a half ago, we did one on health, especially an emphasis on mental health. And then on April 13th, we're doing financial literacy, and we have some planned beyond that. And we try to use like a fireside chat kind of a format, again, so people don't feel intimidated, so they aren't embarrassed. And we try to make sure that people know that no matter where you start in Kenosha with any of the agencies, if it's like Kenosha Human Development Services, where you know, Mike used to work with that group, or anything, if that's not the place that has the services you need, they will navigate you to the correct place. And in Kenosha, we're very fortunate that the agencies all do work closely together. So again, that's an educational opportunity for the whole community. And we have those archived and up on YouTube so they can be shared. And there's another volunteer activity I have has the word learning in it. I'm the president-elect of Adventures in Lifetime Learning. It's a Parkside community partnership with like between 300 and 400 senior citizen members who engage in lectures and classes and a variety of other learning activities. We have been have had a lot of wonderful trips and all that. Right now, we're currently not doing those in-person things, but we have a rich offering of virtual activities right now. And then, as you mentioned with Ray, I'm also a member of LULAC Council 320, and our council has a special focus on education and advocacy in that area. And one of my main roles is as the admin of our Facebook page to disseminate information to the community about the social justice issues that we support.
So Karen, what I'm hearing is you're using your leadership skills that, you know, you learned when you learned to become an educator and that you honed as an educator in the classroom, and you're identifying needs and you're leading the way to get the resources so that people who might not know how to vote, you make them understand who the candidates are. Give them the information. You don't pick a side. You just say these are the information the candidates are providing, and then you take the time to explain those policies, and then most importantly, you help them understand how to vote, and it's not as difficult as it may seem. They just have to understand the process, and then, you know, going out and educating other members of the community how to find resources during COVID. I think that's amazing. It's great that you're out there really using that leadership, getting ideas going, getting people together, and I think thank you, Karen. That's a lot of important things you're doing out in the community. So thank you for all your hard work and for continuing to help Kenosha.
Thank you.
Yeah. This is Mike Flakuski, and you are listening to WGTD 91.1 HD, Education Matters, and we are here with Karen Kapinian, Mike Kehoe, and and Ray Plousius. Mike, so why don't you go next and tell us some of the things you're involved with, in the community here?
Well, during this COVID isolation, because of my age, being 78, obviously I wasn't able to do a lot of things in contact. I've been doing some archive work from home for the Kenosha History Center, been doing some virtual instruction on an informal basis. Been keeping in touch with a lot of my former students. Ray and I once had classrooms on the opposite side of the hall from each other at Edward Bain, and I'm still in touch with a lot of those kids, especially Courtney and Jessica. You will remember. I've stayed in close touch with them. Now they're Courtney's graduated from college and so on. When I became a foster parent, when I was thinking about that, I talked to my folks about it, and they said, understand this when you get into it, that there's no such thing as a former foster parent. Well, it's the same thing with a teacher. You still have those people that you're in contact with. Your kids, former kids who enrich your lives by telling you about what they're doing now. And then they have problems in high school and so on as they're going on, and they call you for advice, even as young adults. So I've been doing that. But on a formal basis, I do some archive work from home for the Kenosha History Center. And recently, I'm going through this tremendous archive of American Motors video and audio that we have. And I found a 1975 interview, a 15-minute interview with a student from Bullen Middle School who had designed the logo for Bullen Middle School, which is now used. I'll send you a copy of the interview, Kieran, if you're interested in it. I won't say his name on the air because I have no idea what he's doing now. But and then I've been working to try and keep the foster grandparent program going. That's been kind of a hiatus this year. But Goodwill, which was administering that, has dropped it. But I'm pleased to let you know that Rebecca Stevens of the Retired Senior Volunteer Program, who's also on the school board, RSVP has filed an application for the contract for that. And those of us who were foster grandparents, who taught in different schools in Kenosha and Racine, we've tried to keep ourselves together as a group, and we're very hopeful. I'm very optimistic that that CAFASI, and which is the name of the sponsor organization for RSVP, and Rebecca will get this contract, and we'll be going strong again. In the meantime, I'm trying to find some way that I can participate in the schools virtually as a tutor. And now that I've had my both of my vaccinations 6 weeks ago, maybe there's some way that I can get back into the schools like Bullen and Reuther and Lincoln and Hillcrest on an in-person basis. There's going to be I also work at Mitchell Middle School in Racine, and some of the teachers there have called me, and they said, this summer we're going to start catching up. We're going to start trying to get back to where we were, and we hope that you're going to be available. I hope I'm going to be able to do some things this summer, and I hope that some of our FGPs will also be able to do some in-person things this summer, because there's a lot of things we can do to contribute.
Mike, can you tell us a little bit about the Foster Grandparents Program? I'm sure a lot of our listeners are not familiar with that program.
Okay, well, in Kenosha, we've had, and in Racine, they've had the Retired Senior Volunteer Program. That is basically for people who want to be mentors and tutors, but it's an hour or two a week. Foster Grandparent Program is for people who want to spend more time. We've always had the limitation of at least 15 hours a week. And in my case, I did it pretty much full time. There's a small stipend that goes along with that because of the greater amount of time that you put in, and your mileage is paid for and so on. It doesn't amount to much, $2.80 an hour, but if you're spending a lot of time, that makes it possible for you to do. You can justify doing it. So that's what we do with foster grandparents. And also the foster grandparent program, we have training throughout the year. We have in-services once a month. We get together as a group. We work with students on a much closer relationship. I work with the same group of kids generally for an entire year, and I'm with them for a longer period of time, and work with them on their subject matter content in a much more substantive way. Mathematics, for example. Everybody sends me their mathematics. All the teachers who are afraid of math would send me their math students who are having difficulties, and I work through them because my father was an engineer. I grew up with math. Teaching math is finding speed bumps. You find the speed bumps, and then the kids can take off and go with it from that point on. I hope that answers your question.
It did. Thanks, Mike. All right, Ray, how about can we hear a little bit about what you do out in the community? I know you're doing a ton of things as well, but just give us some of your highlights.
Well, I did slow down a little bit because of the pandemic, but somehow or another, we found a way around it, and we still continued to meet with other organizations that we partner with, some other local nonprofits. I currently, as I said before, I substitute for the dual language program in Kenosha. I actually went in and substituted during the pandemic because I wanted to experience what the teachers in the buildings had to do or had to deal with when they taught virtually. And so I had the opportunity to teach and work with a first grade class. It was very different experience, but it was very, very rewarding and positive. The children were amazingly well-behaved and interested and on task for the most part during the whole time that I was with them. After their break, they checked back in and we continued our lessons, and it was a good experience. It gave me an idea of how well the teachers had to be prepared, how you had to figure out, especially with the dual language program, how to communicate with the students when they weren't physically present with you. So it offered me the opportunity to think of an alternative that fortunately worked with regards to the fidelity of the program. And by that, I meant the teachers can supposed to continue speaking Spanish and instructing in Spanish in kindergarten and first grade during the whole time of the lesson, and not switch into English when a child doesn't understand. Now, the child can use English, if they choose to try to help them understand. So they kind of rely on each other, which is, that's kind of the purpose of the program, is that they then learn from each other. Spanish-speaking students learn English. English students learn to speak Spanish and become fluent eventually. So I appreciated that opportunity of substituting during the pandemic and having that experience. I'm also a member of LULAC Council 320 of Racine and Kenosha. And as I said, an advocate for the needs and concerns of both students and parents when it comes to the quality of a child's education. We have been called by, asked by staff members in both districts to come in and assist in certain situations or cases where maybe the parent doesn't know what direction or what resources are available to them. Having been a teacher in the district, I'm more familiar with those opportunities, and so I can kind of redirect them and kind of help them to achieve a successful outcome for their child. We had one last year that was two for special needs students whose parents were totally unaware of what their rights were and what the process was. So having had that experience as a teacher, I was able to kind of assist them and be part of their team when they went to meet with staff members from the districts. And this was in Racine Unified. I became a union representative, as I said, in Kenosha, and that was mostly for the Latino teachers in the district who needed, like I said, a voice regarding their concerns. And this role kind of led me then to become a voice for the Latino communities in both Racine and Kenosha for education. As Karen said, our council focuses on education. That's one of our main platforms. And so through that membership, we had the backing at which the districts of Racine and Kenosha became familiar with as one of the largest civil rights groups in the United States. That kind of made them kind of sit up and take notice of who we were and offered us a place at the table. This is when I first started to participate with LULAC, was when there was an Office of Civil Rights case against KUSD, I think it was 1998, that led to the conversion of the transitional bilingual program because a parent had filed a complaint with regards to the education of their child, thinking that it wasn't adequate enough. That opened the door to other models and possibilities. The district then tried out an immersion, a Spanish immersion program, and the dual language program. And out of the three programs, transitional, dual language, and Spanish immersion, the dual language ended up succeeding much more than the other two. The other two are phased out, and dual language continues in the district. Later then, with contact of the students, I became also a state deputy director for young adults, working with students at the universities, UWM, Marquette University, Carthage College, and UW Parkside, and trying to mentor them, trying to encourage them and to become future leaders and take on leadership roles. Some of them already had, and so it was more of a just an include, you know, another position and another opportunity that they had to be trained by LULAC leadership programs to take on even more responsibility. I also became state deputy director for youth, and that allowed me to work with middle school and high school students to form young councils so that they could start getting experience of what leadership looks like and how they can become more involved in their communities. I was also vice president and president of LULAC Council 320 for a number of years for Racine and Kenosha counties. And this allowed me to advocate, again, as I said, for teachers in both counties and students in both counties. And I continue to do so as they call me and whenever they need help. We have a good network of teachers in both counties that usually call and ask for assistance if they need it, or if they are asking for resources and opportunities. So,
thanks, Ray. This is Mike Falkowski, and you are listening to WBTD 91.1 HD Education Matters, and we are here with Karen Kempinian. I'm trying, Karen. Stepping in. There we go. Mike Kehoe and Ray Palacios. Ray, I just want to comment on what you said. I think two things I heard here is, one, using your education skills to be adaptive and saying we you know, we should do this in a way that works for students. So, for example, you know, teaching in Spanish first, which might be someone's native language, I think that's great. It's more important at the learning, and then about the fact that they could feed back and forth and switch and get both groups of students immersed in English and in Spanish. I think that's great for a final outcome. And I really like the fact that being a leader, that you're working to train young people to be leaders. You know, leadership is something I didn't learn until I was older in life. I think it's great when mentors are reaching out and teaching young adults how to be a leader, the first steps, you know, how to be organized, how to communicate and get your thoughts out there. So I really appreciate you doing that. I'm going to move on to our next question. We are coming up to the end of the program, so I'm going to ask for brief answers on these. Just I want to make sure all three of you get a chance to say a few things here, because we have about 9 minutes left. So, Karen, I know you've kind of started with this, but you know, with your leadership role, but what other skills as an educator do you think have really helped you in your roles, you know, in the Uptown area and working with the Kush?
So I'll give a couple of quick examples with voter outreach in Uptown communities. So when we first started our outreach, we were getting together volunteers that would offer rides to early voting, and nobody wanted to take us up on it. And so as a teacher, especially a special educator, you have to analyze, well, what's wrong with my instruction that it's not working? So so I went to the city hall and I took pictures. I took a picture of the door that has the sign, vote here. I took pictures going down the hallway with like the signs down the hallway. I took picture in the room that you go in, and I made a collage of all of those photos. And then Arnetta Griffin would be serving lunch at the Uptown Pantry parking lot. So she let me give a little speech about early voting before she served the food. And then while people were in line, I gave a clipboard to them with my photo collage. And then people would be saying, oh, I know where that is. Oh, yeah, I recognize that. And so that's the kind of thing we do as teachers. If one strategy doesn't work, we try another one. So the photo one worked. So that's one example of how, you know, you can bring your skills to real life.
Yep. Thank you, Karen. How about you, Mike? I know you talked about your relationships with your former students. Or, you know, what other skills from your career as an educator do you think have helped you in your activities with the you know, historical society and other things you're doing?
Well, as far as skills that have helped me with teaching, I would say the most formative experiences, I think everybody in my family, all my siblings would say that growing up in a family with an autistic, seriously disabled person was a transformative experience for all of us. Secondly, extended family, to have you know, an uncle who spent his life as a journalist, who was an extremely important influence on my life. Another one who was a professional educator at the college level, and other teachers in the family. Those kinds of experiences have been really important to me. I think basically what the lesson that I learned from all of this that has helped me so much and makes me effective at what I do is understanding that in education, it's the students who do the learning. The teachers are there to support the students and to open doors and windows for them. And the administrators are there to support the teachers. And I think often we get that ladder mixed up and get the order mixed up. When you understand that the students are the ones who do the heavy lifting in the schools, and what your job is as a teacher is to find out what they're interested in and encourage that interest, and then they will do the learning on their own. The motivation comes from that. I remember my father getting me into a manual labor job because he thought that would that would make me want to learn more. It wasn't. It was not the money. It was not the idea of escaping physical labor that made me a good student. I wasn't a good student at that time. It was finding something I loved. And then my own motivation carried me through.
Thanks, Mike. How about you, Ray? What skills from being an educator have helped you in all your work with LULAC and in the bilingual program?
I think my most effective skills were communication and organization. Those were two skills that really helped me to become an effective leader in both it helped me to become an effective leader and mentor, actually, to the students and to other teachers. Communication allowed me to build a strong relationship in many communities in Racine and Kenosha. I was able to build a strong relationship in many communities, and that relationship I built into a trusting, supportive relationships with educators, communities, students, local politicians, nonprofit organizations, Hispanic organizations in both cities, and even in Milwaukee in some cases, and local universities and colleges and other LULAC councils as well, nationwide. So gaining the trust and respect of my fellow colleagues and others that I met, and assisting and representing them in disciplinary concerns and mentoring either with educational experiences or union issues. I think this reputation that I developed has extended through the word mouth to both districts, and I've become familiar with many dual language teachers in this case, as well as many other people in both communities.
All right, well, we are getting near the end of time. I put some of my final thoughts here. Karen, Mike, and Ray, I think you're all, giants in the community, all the things you have done, as an educator, but even after education, and your big leadership roles, all the things you've helped with the dual language program or voter outreach, and of course, LULAC, all these organizations. But I think one thing I want to just mention to people is, as a retired educator, there's plenty of roles. You don't have to be the giant footstep. You can be the person helping out. You can be the person helping spread the information, doing the teaching. So I just hope this show got some people thinking and realizing the opportunities out there. Even if you're not an educator, just getting out there and helping and filling the shoes. As they say, many hands make light work. So thank you for setting the example and showing that, teachers are educators, leaders their entire lives, not just for that 30 to 40 years they're in the classroom, but they continue outside. And I think that's really exciting. And I think, actually, I know Kenosha, Racine, and everywhere where retired teachers are working are much better communities because our retired educators are out in the community helping out, making things better, getting information to people, solving problems, getting people to work together. I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg. You guys all do millions of things. That's really incredible. And so I think society really owes you guys a lot. So Karen, Mike, and Ray, thank you for being on the show today. I thank you for your time. And I hope our listeners will have a great rest of your day.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page. From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, celebrate Earth Day and EcoFest Racine with drive-through activities on the campuses of Gateway, Saturday, April 17th from 9 until 11. While supplies last, pick up free garden kits, tree seedlings, kids' activities, and compost bags, and drop off unwanted electronics. Then from 11 to 1, activities, presentations, and workshops shift online. RSVP now for the online portion by going to Facebook. Search for Celebrate Earth Day and EcoFest Racine.
Good morning. I'm Steve Brown, co-executive producer of the WGTD Radio Theater. This morning, a rebroadcast of the award-winning And on the Eighth Day, a look at the 1925 Scopes Monkey Trial that took place in Dayton, Tennessee, starring as William Jennings Bryan, Rob Lamont, and as Clarence Darrow, the late Terry Lawler. Support for the WGTD Radio Theater comes from the Kenosha Law Firm of Aaliyah, Dumay, and McTernan. And now, And on the Eighth Day, written and produced by Michael Ostrup and myself, Steve Brown.
That saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found, was blind, but now I see. 'Twas grace that
So I don't really understand why some people want to know about my father, Amyras Darrow. He was a bookish man and not the most practical. He always dedicated himself to large causes, none more so than the abolition of slavery. Seward. I am Clarence Seward Darrow. Yep. Middle name for William Henry Seward, abolitionist through and through. Now you might find this difficult to believe, especially after hearing, in a bit, how I hardly spared the rod when I took on Mr. Bryan in the Scopes cross-examination. My father graduated from seminary school, but he could not, would not preach. I, like all the rest of my brothers and sisters, inherited my politics and my religion from my father. One thing I did not get from him is my love for baseball. I have snatched my share of joys in my long life, but never has life held for me anything quite so entrancing as baseball. And please, please don't get me going about the Cubs. I'll wait for that till next year bromide, as everyone always says.
Nearer, my God, to thee, nearer to thee.
That must be WJ and is my cue to sit down.
Be across.
This might take a while.
Praiseth me. Still all my song shall be, nearer my God to thee, nearer my God to thee, nearer to thee. In the beginning, I had three ambitions. Yes, sir. I had them by the time I was just a mere lad of six, while living at the old homestead in Salem, Illinois. The first was to become a Baptist preacher, due doubtless to the fact that my father was a member of that church. My father reminded me about that after he had taken me to that church one hot August evening for an immersion during a very long evening of preaching. I remember, like it were only yesterday, seeing the convert going down in the pool of water to be baptized. She was standing right there in front of me when this happened. I do remember thinking long and hard about that entire evening. Then I asked my father whether I would have to go down into that pool of water in order to become a Baptist minister. Well, he said, without batting an eye, yes. After that, they could never get me to say I was going to be a Baptist preacher.
W.J., and what were the other two ambitions? W.J., you will move your story along, won't you?
I shall, Clarence, I shall. You're usually the long-winded one in the court of law. Now, where was I? Ambition, oh yes, my second ambition was to become a farmer and raise pumpkins. Not sure why. My third ambition was to be a lawyer, probably due to the fact that my father was a lawyer and a circuit judge. I used to go down to the courthouse and sit upon the steps leading up to the bench and listen to the trials.
Too bad you didn't decide to become a farmer. One reaps what he sows, W.J. Pumpkins, huh?
Those memories in court stayed with me long after I chose not to be immersed in water or to go around thumping those plump pumpkins to see if they were ripe.
Well, everyone here is ripe with desire to pit the two of us against each other, W.J.
Again. Let me close by saying, and if I may quote the writer, Eugene Field, Father calls me William, and Mother calls me Will. Sister calls me Billy, but the fellers call me Bill.
And I?
This is a family proceeding, so I shall say, dearest Clarence, that you can and do call me W.J.
Why, of course. W.J., you know that I have only the highest respect and admiration for you.
Clarence, I know that you do. And my friend, you know that I always enjoy taking those little snipey jabs at you.
Of course, I know that. But you also remember that I was a delegate to the 1896 Democratic Convention. Your cross of gold speech was spellbinding.
You'll never let me forget that, will you?
But anyway, W.J., I made it a point to tell you then how remarkable your speech was.
Yes, you did, which was very kind of you. Quite unusual for you now.
Well, that's not true, W.J. You were, and perhaps still are, the true voice of the Democratic Party.
That would not be difficult to do, especially when there usually isn't anyone like that who would dare enter the political arena.
W.J., let's get to the Scopes trial.
I was wondering when you would allow us to do that.
The small rural town of Dayton, Tennessee, the Rhea County Courthouse.
You might be wondering why Dayton, such a small place.
I wasn't wondering, but nevertheless, tell me.
Why should the size of the town be a matter of importance in this famous trial? Christianity began in a small town, regardless of when and how we determine the date of when that all started.
W.J., all of the newspapers that covered this trial certainly made fun of Dayton, a nowhere town in a forgotten wasteland.
Why should not this peaceful and serene community be the backdrop for a trial that involves the greatest subjects that interest mankind, education and religion?
Scopes. John Thomas Scopes, just a young man in his mid-20s.
We must also understand this young man, and I believe I do. He was used, manipulated.
Oh, don't you think, W.J., that he has a right to teach the appropriate curriculum?
The key word there is appropriate. I do believe I have a copy of the Butler Act that spells out why Mr. Scopes broke the law by teaching evolution. My dear wife Mary always wryly smiled when I used that word.
William, since you mentioned my name, I thought this would be a good time for everyone to meet me.
Splendid idea, Mary.
It's good to see you again, Mary.
Thank you, Clarence. I thought I should give the two of you a chance to catch your breath and allow me to help move the story along for this experience.
C.D., as I've always told you, Mary has a will of her own. Like a fast-moving train, sometimes hard to stop.
Like it or not, I will try to keep the two of you on the right track. Mr. Bryan's stand against evolution is not a new one, not at all. His opposition to the theory finds its way back to 1911, when he gave his now-famous Prince of Peace lecture.
I remember that speech, Mary. W.J. gave it at numerous Chautauquas and other religious meetings all over the world.
That I did, Clarence, and I did so because I could not accept that a monkey was one of my ancestors.
What I still have a problem with, W.J., is that you wanted only Christians to be teachers in our universities and in our public schools.
I still feel that way.
Just for the record, let me mention another point of view that Mr. Bryan had, and that was a real belief in the importance of the separation of church and state. He believed in absolute equality before the law of all religious denominations. He would believe that all sects should advance their religion by their own efforts and at their own expense, unaided by the state. But his soul rose in righteous indignation when he found from the many letters he received from parents all over the country that state schools were being used to undermine the religious faith of their children. He argued that if the power of state could not be properly used to advance religion, well, it followed as a matter of course that the power of the state must not be used to attack religion.
Still do.
When delivering lectures, William found his audiences were in some respect different from his political audience. Real people. People who were looking for guidance from a voice of reason and intellect. After some of those speeches, people came up to shake his hand and often said things that would stay with you for years and years. Oh, as this weeping mother once said to Mr. Bryan, "How I wish our son could have heard you speak. He's lost his faith. He has just slipped away."
I can believe that. When you spoke, people truly listened. You could fill a whole convention center or a large football stadium with your voice. Or should I say your very presence?
Mary, I think we should move along with our story. You better keep an eye on that Mencken fellow. That fool of a man continues to write lies about me.
Oh, yes. Mencken was an incredibly literate, well-read, and thoughtful fool. But a fool nonetheless.
WJ, I believe you were about to educate us all on the Butler Act.
Well, here it is, right where I knew it would be. Now, Clarence, let me reiterate to you what this Butler Act is all about.
Hold on, WJ. Let me give you my full and undivided attention now that your lovely missus is gone.
Well, the Act says that it shall be unlawful for any teacher in any of the universities and all other public schools of the state, which are supported by the public school funds of the state, to teach any theory that denies the story of the divine creation of man as taught in the Bible, and to teach instead that man has descended from a lower order of animals. Seems pretty darn clear to me, Clarence.
Oh, not so fast. Let me remind you, WJ, of what it does not say. It was technically not illegal to teach that apes had ultimately descended from protozoa, or to teach the mechanisms of variation and natural selection. It was only illegal to teach that man had descended from a lower order of animal.
So God created man in his own image, in the image of God created he him?
Genesis chapter 1, verse 27.
In my book.
Yes, I know. Your book, in his image. I have it right here. Now, this is where you always get bogged down. In chapter 4 of your book, here, the chapter title is The Origin of Man.
Just listen to this. Having given Darwin's conclusions as to man's ancestry, I shall quote him to prove that his hypothesis is not only groundless, but absurd and harmful to society. It is groundless because there is not a single fact in the universe that can be cited to prove that man is descended from the lower animals. Darwin does not use facts. He uses conclusions drawn from similarities.
Oh, and of course, WJ, you want everyone to discount all of the scientific findings, artifacts, documentation, all lies, balderdash, right?
I'm going to ignore the tirade you just exhibited and continue.
As you always do.
He builds upon presumptions, probabilities, and inferences. He then advances an hypothesis which, if true, would find support on every foot of the Earth's surface, but which, as a matter of fact, finds support nowhere. Nowhere.
WJ, I think we should saunter into the courthouse. Seems about time for Judge Ralston to pound his gavel.
Before we get into the courthouse, I think we need to talk about one more thing.
Which is?
You.
Me? Why?
What is your own personal attitude toward religion?
Oh, here we go. Back to chapter 1 of your book. In the beginning, God.
Yes, that is the first chapter of In His Image. Please answer my question, Clarence.
I feel as I always have, that the earth is the home and the only home of man. And I am convinced that whatever he is to get out of his existence, he must get while he is here.
If we are to discuss creation, it should be based on asking and answering questions.
I'm an agnostic because I am not afraid to think. Nor am I afraid to answer your questions, or to ask them. I am not afraid of any God in the universe that would send me or any other man or woman to hell. If there were such a being, he would not be a God, he would be a devil.
Go ahead, Clarence. Ask me the first question that you always like to ask.
You see, do you see how he loves to bait me?
You love asking a good Christian man like myself the number one question.
Yes, you're right. And that question is, where do you begin?
I begin where the Bible begins. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. I also begin with a creative cause that is sufficient for anything that can come thereafter.
Well, go ahead. Ask me your follow-up question, WJ.
My question always causes you and other non-believers lots of trouble. Where do you begin?
If there is a soul, what is it? And where did it come from? And where does it go? Can anyone who is guided by his reason possibly imagine a soul independent